Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to the New Books Network. I'm Stephen Pimper, host of the Public Policy Channel, and I am joined today by Eric Potashnick, who is the author of Counter-Mobilization, Policy Feedback and Backlash in a Polarized Age from the University of Chicago Press. Eric, welcome. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much. It's a real pleasure to be here.
So I wonder if you might start us off by telling folks a little bit about who you are and what brought you to this project.
Sure. So I am a political science professor at Brown University. I study American politics and public policy. And a lot of my work has been about what happens after policies are enacted and how battles over legislation doesn't end when bills are signed, but often continues into the post-enactment stage. So what I've done here in my book, Counter-Mobilization, is write a book about the dynamics of policy backlash in the United States since the 1960s. Now, I think many of us are familiar with, you know, the backlashes against the civil rights movement, perhaps issues like Roe v. Wade. But what I try to show in this book is that backlash dynamics, the mobilization of the public and organized groups when there is a change or an attempted change in the status quo, is really an endemic feature of our political landscape. And in order to make sense of how polarized and contentious contemporary American government is, we have to do more than simply look at the beliefs that different groups have and about the tribalism that we're facing. And those are very important factors. But we also have to put public policy back at the center, because really what groups and citizens care about is how government affects their lives. And what I show in the book is that when politicians are making changes or threatening to make changes that overreach public opinion or that threaten existing institutions or people's values, they often counter-mobilize. And that's really a very, very important dynamic in the contemporary American political landscape.
Terrific. So I want to make sure that we pay some attention to at least some of the particular cases that you walk through in the book. But I wonder if we can start by doing just a little bit of the broader brush clearing and theoretical foundations. So you point to what you argue are three key features that create bright conditions for backlash that have to do with motive, means, and opportunities. I wonder if you might walk through each of us for us and tell us what you think are the important factors that create space for a backlash.
Yeah. And so, and just to be clear, I think it might be helpful to give just a couple of examples of the kinds of cases I'm talking about. So, you know, I'm thinking about, for example, the conservative backlashes against abortion and same-sex marriage and civil rights, the labor union and environmentalist backlash against the North American Free Trade Agreement, NAFTA, the populist backlash against the government's bailout of Wall Street through troubled assets relief program, the senior citizen backlash against the Medicare Catastrophic Coverage Act, the backlash against managed care plans in the 90s, the parental backlash against high-stakes testing in public schools, the Tea Party and conservative backlash against the Affordable Care Act, the protest against COVID-19 restrictions issued by governors and state public health agencies, and of course, very recently, we've seen the public backlash against the Supreme Court's decision in Dobbs v. Jackson, which eliminated the national right to abortion. And I'd say that there are, you know, to understand why backlash is such an endemic feature of our politics is, first of all, there are some contextual factors that are that increase backlash. One of them is we're living in an era of hyperpolarization. Whether that polarization is driven by, you know, genuine ideological differences over the role of government or just strategic incentives of the parties to win elections in an era of really, you know, razor-thin majorities, party leaders increasingly are engaging in the mobilization of backlash in order to activate their base supporters and try to win elections. The other contextual factor I think that's really important is that American culture and society has changed dramatically since, say, the early 60s. We've had large-scale immigration. The U.S. population has become more racially and ethnically diverse. Black Americans, the LGBTQ community, and other marginalized groups have gained rights and acceptance. And millions of Americans have embraced these changes. And actually, public opinion has moved left on many issues, from same-sex marriage, women's equality, and others. But there are other Americans, non-college graduates, religious conservatives, and white residents of rural communities who hold traditionalist values and have felt threatened by the growing secularism and diversity of American society. And some of these citizens, you know, have found these changes very disorienting and, you know, feel like they're strangers in their own land. And so there's a really large political divide between urban and small town America that is helping to intensify backlash dynamics. And then the third and final broad contextual trend, I think that's important to understand backlash, is the negative policy feedback from the expansion of activist government itself. Since the 1960s, there's been a dramatic expansion in government in a wide array of areas, from healthcare to education to the environment. And that expansion of government has built supportive constituencies in many areas. There are a lot of interest groups that, you know, rely on those programs and that lobby to see their programs funded and continued. Senior citizens like their Medicare, healthcare providers, and so on. But at the same time, the broadening of the federal government's role has imposed costs on some other actors, such as business corporations. And so as a result of this vast expansion and broadening of government, we have seen the federal government, you know, pulling more and more groups into the political arena. And some of those groups are counter-mobilizing against government activity, believing that they're imposing costs on their activities. So those are some of the broad contextual factors that I think are making backlash so endemic. But then, as you said, the means, motives, and opportunities, what I try to show in the book is that backlashes are not random events. This is when it happens, when citizens and groups mobilize against changes or threaten changes in the federal role. To some degree, it's predictable ahead of time. Not all changes, in other words, have a very high probability of triggering backlash. And what I argue in the book is that there are three sets of factors that increase the probability of backlash. So one of them is whether the design of public policies themselves, the attributes of public policies, give particular constituencies incentives to counter-mobilize. And why would that happen? Well, there are a couple of different kinds of attributes that can increase the probability of backlash. One of them is if policies impose concentrated costs on particular constituencies, such as costs on a particular geographic community or an identity group. And also, I would say, the literature suggests if the costs are in the near term, people are much more likely or likelier to notice, you know, a $50 increase in their grocery bill tomorrow than, you know, a $300 increase in their long-term tax burden over 20 years. People are very, very sensitive to near-term costs. There could be threats to the status of people who rely on or are strongly attached to existing arrangements. So, for example, part of the reason why there was a backlash against the Affordable Care Act was senior citizens perceived that the creation of the law was going to threaten the funding of the Medicare program on which they relied. Many defenders of the ACA argued that wasn't really true, but there was a sense of fear and threat that the expansion of healthcare under the ACA was going to take money from the existing Medicare program. It was going to thereby make the program less solvent and degrade the quality of healthcare offered to existing beneficiaries.
And sometimes it's the perception that matters rather than the reality.
Yeah, you just raise a really, really good point. And although I believe that policy design matters a lot, perception is key. And that can vary. You know, there are some kinds of policies where ordinary citizens can see with their own eyes. They have their understanding very well. If gas prices are going up, perception and reality are kind of one and the same. But for a lot of complicated or novel issues, citizens might not have a very good understanding. They might be relying on their intuitions or cues that they get from trusted groups. And you're right, it's how people perceive the effects of policies, not always the actual incidence of costs and benefits. Some of the other policy attributes that can stimulate backlash, including when there's a perception that policies are providing benefits to groups that are perceived as undeserving, that are socially constructed by policy as undeserving, that can generate a sense of anger or resentment. That was another factor that I think that contributed to the backlash against the ACA, the feeling that some of the beneficiaries who might be receiving quite good healthcare under the ACA might be unemployed, might not be perceived as deserving. And then there were some workers or some Americans, because of their income and the complexity of the law, didn't necessarily qualify for large subsidies on the exchanges, or maybe they lived in a state that didn't offer Medicaid. And so some of those constituencies were sort of saying, wait a minute, I'm working really hard at my job. My health care isn't very good. Why is this law giving benefits to some other groups? And then, of course, racial politics, racial stereotypes, all of those kinds of factors can definitely mediate the perceptions of which groups are perceived as deserving. And then there can simply be overreaching, just, parties or elected officials pushing policies that are, way out of sync with the preferences of voters, or that are, pushing government to work on a problem that's not very important, not a priority for ordinary voters. That can also lead to counter mobilization. I think that was one factor that contributed to the backlash under the cap and trade bill that was proposed during the Obama administration to deal with climate change. That was coming after the Great Recession. It was perceived to increase the energy costs of ordinary Americans. At the time, a lot of Americans were struggling economically, dealing with climate change, even though it's obviously an extremely important problem, was not really a top priority for a lot of Americans. And it looked like policymakers were pushing the government to focus on a problem that wasn't a high priority for ordinary voters.
And was a less obvious, urgent problem, arguably, right?
Yes, that's right. At the time, I think coming out of the Great Recession, people were just worried about keeping their job, making ends meet. Even some Americans that would recognize that climate is a really important issue, that wasn't necessarily what they thought was the most urgent problem at the moment. So in all of those and some other ways, the design of policies can shape the probability of backlash. But then there are two other factors. The means and opportunities, I would say, also shape backlash dynamics. So if a group is going to counter-mobilize, that is not necessarily an automatic event just because they're suffering a loss. To participate in politics requires resources. It requires political information, the ability to write letters, the free time to join a protest. And a lot of groups might not be able to overcome the barriers to collective action. In other words, just because a constituency is targeted by policy doesn't mean necessarily that they will be able to counter-mobilize. And in fact, because participation in politics is costly, unfortunately, that can mean that Backlist dynamics can often reinforce inequalities in political resources. Some of the most marginalized groups that are arguably the ones that, should be counter-mobilizing against government the most might not have the capacity to do so. And then finally, the political opportunity structure creates external incentives for counter-mobilization. When there are, for example, in an era of polarization, divided elites, that's going to make backlashes, if they're beginning to gather some strength at the grassroots level, that's going to amplify them and make them much stronger. Because if government passes a policy that some constituency is unhappy with, but pretty much all the political elites think the policy is a good idea, and they all are supportive, it's going to be hard for that loss-bearing constituency to find elite allies. But if the elites are polarized and they're divided among themselves, as we see often in many cases today, well, that constituency might find that one of the parties is willing to rally to their side, and that's going to really help their counter-mobilization build momentum.
So you've hinted at this, but is backlash necessarily a bad thing?
It's a great question. As I've defined backlash, which is simply a mobilization or widely noticed resistance against a change or attempted change in the status quo, it's not necessarily a bad thing. The colloquial understanding of backlash as white backlash or simply a reactionary response to advancement of social rights is a narrower definition that I'm using in the book. I'm defining backlash more inclusively, even though I show empirically in the book that most backlash, as is true, I think, with our intuition, does come from the right, is not simply a right-wing or phenomenon. It can come from a variety of different directions, as we're seeing in, for example, the backlash against the withdrawal of reproductive rights since the overturning of Roe. And so what I argue is that backlash per se is not good or bad, even though backlashes do have very, very important implications, normative implications for democracy and for the allocation of rights. We have to, in other words, analyze each backlash episode separately from describing it. And some backlashes might be very important for promoting political accountability. Indeed, if backlash were not possible, like we're seeing today in the backlash against Dobbs, then it would be much harder for voters and citizens to signal that they are not satisfied with the direction of policy change. But at the same time, backlash does not necessarily lead to the public good. Backlashes can happen when there's efforts to solve collective problems like climate change. Backlashes can happen when policymakers are providing benefits to marginalized groups or trying to promote democracy. And so, I think it's really important to map when backlashes occur, understand their conditions, and recognize that they have important normative implications, but those normative implications need to be analyzed separately, not folded into the definition of backlash itself.
They can also serve important policymaking opportunities, right? They could be learning opportunities for legislators, yes?
Yes, and I think that's true. I mean, if the American political system were working perfectly efficiently, well, then policymakers would always make decisions.
There's no risk of that.
Yeah. It's not. And so what we see is that backlashes can be at times, not always, but at times an opportunity for policymakers to gain knowledge about the acceptability of unfeasibility of different solutions to problems. So, for example, the backlash against the cap and trade bill during the Obama administration, I think, was, even though it was a negative experience, it slowed progress on climate change for over a decade, I think policymakers did learn from that episode. And so we saw, for example, in the design of the climate provisions of the Inflation Reduction Act passed under the Biden administration, there was an effort to take a very different approach. Rather than an approach that was going to impose perceived costs on ordinary Americans, instead we're providing essentially carrots rather than sticks, providing subsidies for, solar panels and for the green energy transition. And, even though there are some certainly some organized groups that want to block the implementation of the Inflation Reduction Act. On the whole, we've not seen the kind of intense public backlash against those provisions that we saw under cap and trade, and it's more likely to be sustainable. And so, you know, there's an example, and there are many others where some of these episodes where policymakers were trying to solve a problem, they took an approach that antagonized groups, but then over time they realized, you know what, a different approach might be more effective.
We could say the same about the substance and the process of the efforts to create the Affordable Care Act, having learned from the Clinton-era efforts at healthcare reform, yes?
Yes, I would say so. I mean, I think the Affordable Care Act is certainly not a perfect act. It is. I study health policy. I have a kid at the moment who's taking advantage of the Affordable Care Act. And so, you know, I'm quite appreciative of its benefits, but also aware of its limitations. But the design of the policy itself did reflect policy learning. The Bill Clinton healthcare plan was in some ways much more ambitious. It was a much more heavy-handed plan. The Obama plan relies more heavily on the existing healthcare system. It's a patchwork reform. It leaves in place some of the flaws of the existing system, but it did expand health insurance through the exchanges and especially the Medicaid program in ways that left intact a lot of existing arrangements. And that was necessary both to pass the law, which was a major accomplishment. And as strong as the backlash was against the ACA for its first decade or so of operation, the core of the benefit expansion, I think, you know, has now proven that it will endure because people are relying on it. We're not seeing currently Republican candidates talking about repealing the core benefit provisions of the law. And part of the reason for that story is that the law was designed to tread lightly on existing arrangements, the people who already had health insurance, and find ways of expanding coverage without threatening existing programs and private insurance to which people were strongly attached.
I wonder if we should hang there for a minute, because we've got the passage of the Affordable Care Act and a counter mobilization, and then we wind up with a counter mobilization, right? Can you talk a little bit about how that played out and what we should learn from it?
Yeah, that was, of course, one of my favorite cases in the book. And I should say the book consists of both an overview of backlash dynamics, but then detailed case studies of healthcare and trade policy and immigration and social policy reforms, as well as some instances of conditions where backlashes could have happened, but didn't materialize. And I try to explain why. But yes, in the ACA case, what was fascinating was this remarkably intense decade-long war against the ACA, led by Republicans and conservative activists, much, much more intense than we saw, for example, after the passage of the Medicare bill in 1965. There was certainly an effort to block its passage by physicians and the AMA. But once the Medicare bill was passed in 1965, people adjusted to it very quickly. There was no effort to sort of, you know, destroy it or find it unconstitutional. That was a less polarized era than the context in which the ACA was passed. And so we saw a remarkable, you know, unique, intense effort to try to eliminate and scale back the ACA in every possible arena, from state legislators to courts throughout the country. And that backlash had, you know, did achieve some success from the standpoint of the advocates. The feature of the ACA that was most disliked, viewed as most coercive, was, of course, the individual mandate, which we no longer have. There was the Independent Payment Advisory Board, which provider groups and medical device companies and others were concerned were going to cut into their profits. Well, IPAV no longer exists. Some of the taxes in the bill, the medical device tax and others, those were scrapped. And so the backlash did have some actual substantive payoff from the standpoint of those that were engaging in it. And in fact, it also had political payoff. The Republicans did very well in the 2010 midterms, for example. And research shows that Democrats from marginal districts who voted for the ACA were really hammered. And so, you know, the ACA was a historic accomplishment for the Democratic Party, but there was a political price to be paid, and with a loss of seats in power. And so Over time, though, what I think became fascinating was when finally, during the Trump administration, the Republicans finally, you know, had the opportunity to make good on their effort to repeal and replace the law. And they had proposed, you know, hundreds, if not thousands of laws to try to do that over the previous decade. When they finally, it came time to try to do it, they couldn't do it because it was just so unpopular. The repeal and replace laws, those efforts were some of the most unpopular bills in modern American history. It did come very close to passage with people like John McCain preventing it. But by the time that that came up, you know, many Americans were increasingly relying on the law, didn't want to see it scrapped. And so there was actually a backlash of the backlash. And finally, the effort to defend the ACA, which had not really paid political dividends to the Democrats, it had been a difficult issue for them for a long time, it finally became one that redounded to their advantage. So it's a remarkable example of how you could have a backlash that, you know, creates real risk to a law's policy sustainability. And then finally, the effort to undo it itself creates a backlash in the opposite direction.
And to pick up on something that you said earlier, this is among the many lessons that you point out that policymakers might consider as they're drafting policy. If you can front load benefits rather than have them come in over a long period of time, you are reducing the risk that there will be successful backlash. Yes?
Yes. And so in the book, I talk about some specific tactical things that policy designers can do. And really what's important is both finding ways on the positive side to build supportive constituencies by, for example, front-loading benefits, while also minimizing, you know, near-term visible costs that are likely to be mobilized opponents. And I go through a list of a variety of specific tactical choices that decision makers can use. More generally, I think, you know, when policymakers are confronted with the prospect of a backlash for, you know, let's say that the law, they truly believe in it, it's a good law, it's going to solve a problem. And, you know, their assessment of the political landscape is that backlash is quite likely, they have some choices. They can, you know, ignore the backlash and just continue ahead. You know, that may create some risk that the backlash may be so strong that it threatens the law's initial adoption and sustainability. They could lean into the backlash because they may believe that the groups that are opposing the law are fundamentally not only wrongheaded, but illegitimate. And so they want to try to actually generate conflict because they believe the conflict might have long-term benefits to coalitional politics, although that can be a risky endeavor. Or they can lower their sights and they could compromise and they could say, you know, we're going to take a half a loaf. We're not going to be as ambitious as we were. Maybe we just won't push for as ambitious a policy design. Or they could also try to use some of these tactics to try to still achieve their substantive goals while using the details of policy design to manage backlash risks. And as I discuss in the book, there's really no one strategy that's right for all circumstances. And it's going to depend a lot on the details of the situation. And what I try to do in the book is just make, you know, actors, whether they're policymakers or advocates or organizers, aware of these dynamics so that they can reflect on them and make a deliberate choice, whatever their particular goals are.
And to go back to where we started, why is this more common in this period of hyperpolarization?
Well, I think, you know, parties are really well designed to fight. I'm thinking about, David Mayhew had argued at one point that, a party is basically a coalition that mobilizes. And so if there's a party that is angry about the enactment of a law and it stays angry, it is going to have tremendous capacity to help actors overcome the cost of collective action, coordinate coordinate that mobilization like happened in the ACA. Think about, you know, all the disparate actors that came together to try to undo the ACA, from ideological conservatives to grassroots citizens who were members of the Tea Party, to business groups and pharmaceutical companies and device companies and others. And, you know, having a party that can try to provide shared information and frames and narratives that always really lowers the transaction costs of counter mobilization, and it facilitates, you know, that kind of dynamic. And so as our two parties have become more polarized, I think that is really fed into backlash dynamics in eras where, you know, during the 1960s, our society was tremendously polarized on issues like race and Vietnam, but those fights did not exactly map onto the two-party system. And I think that's one of the reasons why, you know, American politics circa 2023 is so contentious. It's not only we're divided into tribes and have these deep divisions about race and gender and the role of government, but those are not simply divides that are, you know, found across the entire citizenry. Increasingly, partisan lines are mapping onto these other lines about fundamental beliefs about the role of government.
So we are recording this shortly after the November elections of 2023, and folks have been talking about the presidential election of 2024 and looking at the outcome of these most recent elections. There are a lot of folks who are saying there seems to be clearly a role that the Dobbs counter mobilization played in the Kentucky governor's race, in the Virginia House and Senate race, in the Ohio, obviously, ballot initiative race. And I've already read a number of people saying part of the trick now is we have to figure out how to sustain that. And we should be thinking about organizing the 2024 election around that issue. We should use the reaction against Dobbs as a way to do some of what it is that you just said and overcome some of those obstacles to collective action. Any thoughts on that?
Well, the Dobbs decision and its aftermath, I think, has been absolutely remarkable. First of all, it underscores, I think, one of the key points that I want to make in the book, and that is, as important as white backlash is, and reactionary backlash, and it's absolutely a fundamental dynamic in our politics, the backlash phenomenon is much broader than that. And we are seeing that. We've seen an increase in liberal backlash because inherited rights, from reproductive rights to voting rights and many other areas, are under greater threat as the Republican Party has radicalized. The backlash against the Dobbs decision played a huge role in the Democrats' better than expected performance in the 2022 midterms. It's been a major factor every time there's been a ballot initiative against on abortion rights. It's been, from the standpoint of the Republican Party, just, you know, an albatross. I think, you know, many principled conservatives are pro-life, and they believed that this is the right decision for society. But from a political standpoint, it has been really, really, I think, a disaster for the Republican Party. You know, for many years, the Republican Party did not actually have to face up to the consequences of their support for eliminating Roe, because it was kind of an abstraction. But it's very different when the right is actually withdrawn. And what we've seen is that, you know, a belief that reproductive freedom is important, is an important part of an understanding of liberty in America, is widely shared by many Americans, not only by liberals, but by some people who vote for Republicans. They just don't believe that it is something that the government should be interfering with. And so from the standpoint of the Republican Party, it is a very, very big dilemma for them, because the more salient debates are about abortion, the more difficult it has been. I think what we saw in the Virginia elections, you know, Governor Youngkin has been trying to find some kind of compromise ground and move out to the part of public opinion, because, you know, parts of the public, I think, you know, are not comfortable with very late term abortions, for example. The problem is that Americans don't have a lot of confidence right now that any policy that would restrict, for example, only late-term abortion would stop there, because there's still, you know, a belief that a lot of conservatives would like to create a national abortion ban or constitutionalize fetal personhood, and so that is a huge problem for the Republican Party going forward, and there's just no confidence among a lot of Americans that there really could be any kind of stopping point, because there are lots of conservatives that have expressed quite publicly their belief in there should be, you know, a national abortion ban, for example. And so until the Republican Party finds a way of managing those tensions, it's going to be a major dilemma for them.
You are listening to the Public Policy Channel of the New Books Network, and we have been speaking with Eric Potashnick, who's the author of Countermobilization: Policy Feedback and Backlash in a Polarized Age, new out from University of Chicago Press. You ought to check it out, not only because it does a couple of things to my mind. One, really nicely synthesizes the feedback literature in one place in a way that I found just really sort of clear and helpful. Two, as you have heard, helps us think through the ways in which these mobilizations have played out across a range of issues over time, and how to think about why they happen when they do and why they don't happen when they don't. And finally, as you've just heard, I think provides really immediately useful ways of thinking about this current moment and the kinds of policy battles that we are having at the moment. So I urge all sorts of folks to go out and check it out. Eric, thank you so much for joining us. Really much appreciated.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.